It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station, broadcasting from cold, snowy Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 16 degrees under what they're calling a light snow, but looks like more of a medium snow to me. We're looking at wind speeds of, from the west to 8 miles per hour at the airport right now, gusting to 18. And we're looking for mostly cloudy skies for the rest of the day. Looks like pretty much completely cloudy. We may not reach our high of 18. West wind to 30, gusting to 40 today. For tonight, partly cloudy, low of 16. Northwest winds to 30, gusting to 50 tonight. And they're calling for partly sunny skies tomorrow, with a high near 22. Those northwest winds continuing, gusting as high as 50 tomorrow as well. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Koniag Education Foundation has reached one of its funding goals. The National Science Foundation is helping out the University of Alaska Fairbanks as they study ice melt. And sockeye markets are looking good, at least up in Bristol Bay. Those stories and more after national stories.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Omicron variant of coronavirus is confirmed in the United States. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports the Biden administration says the country's first case was detected in California.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, the president's chief medical advisor, says the individual in California returned from South Africa on November 22nd and tested positive a week later. The person is now self-isolating.
The individual was fully vaccinated and experienced mild symptoms, which are improving at this point.
Fauci says this is the first case of COVID-19 caused by the Omicron variant detected in the United States, but adds that they knew that it was just a matter of time before one was discovered. He says the case further emphasizes the need for people to get vaccinations as well as booster shots. Dr. Fauci says the person was vaccinated, but apparently had not yet received a booster shot. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
The U.S. Supreme Court's conservative majority is signaling support for upholding a Mississippi law that bans abortions after 15 weeks. As NPR Sarah McCammon reports, a case could overturn the court's landmark 1973 ruling Roe v. Wade that legalized abortion nationwide.
If this law is upheld, we will very likely see other conservative states pass similar laws and try to restrict abortion even further beyond 15 weeks. Abortion rights opponents would like to see nationwide bans on abortion, and so this could potentially down the road open the door to federal legislation if Republicans could get enough power in Congress and the presidency. They don't have the votes for that, of course, right now, but that is a long-term goal of the anti-abortion rights movement, and this case could open that door.
NPR's Sarah McCammon. A 15-year-old boy identified as Ethan Crumley is now being charged as an adult with murder, attempted murder, and terrorism for yesterday's high school shooting in Oxford, north of Detroit. Four students died. Several other people were wounded. Congress is working to avoid a debt-defaulting government shutdown, but Democrats push to approve President Biden's nearly $2 trillion Build Back Better spending package may end up happening without a single Republican vote in the evenly split Senate. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports a left-leaning think tank is trying to help prove the bill's value to voters.
A new report from the center-left think tank Third Way looked at what the bill means practically for families, considering changes to the child tax credit, child care cost caps, and expanded health care provisions. It found that a two-parent family of four would save over $7,000 a year. Republicans argue the package is a form of government overreach and that inflation will only worsen if the bill becomes law. But Third Way's Zach Moeller points to the bill as a tool to combat rising costs.
In this era of inflation, one of the most important things about the Build Back Better Act is it focuses on costs that working families often worry about, such as childcare and health care.
The bill has passed the House and now faces changes in the Senate.
This is NPR News.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
The Koniag Education Foundation reached a longtime goal in mid-August as their endowment reached $10 million. It's been a long journey to reach this point. Executive Director Jesse Krager says the organization started small with a $4,000 endowment nearly three decades ago.
Koniag Education Foundation was founded in 1994 by Koniag Incorporated. At that time, their board of directors was looking to the future, and they knew that an educated shareholder base would be instrumental in creating the next leaders at the corporation, as well as supporting the whole community on Kodiak and our shareholders wherever they might be in their efforts to attain education in whatever form that might take.
The Koniag Education Foundation says it uses its endowment to support shareholders and descendants seeking education and provides about 200 students with an average of around $4,000 each of assistance. Krager says that the foundation is looking ahead to its next goal.
We want to exist to support our shareholders and descendants, not only right now and not only in the next 20 years, but the next generation, three generations beyond, and in perpetuity. We're really thinking long-term about how we can position ourselves for growth and continued support of our shareholders and descendants.
Krager says their goal is to grow the endowment to $20 million by 2028. Salmon processors in Bristol Bay are boosting the prices per pound for sockeye amid favorable markets. Preliminary data released by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game suggests better prices and increased demand over 2020 salmon season. That improvement extends beyond Bristol Bay as more fisheries across the state had better harvests this year, as KDLG's Thompson reports.
Processors like Silver Bay Seafoods and Peter Pan Seafoods have adjusted its ex-vessel price, or price per pound for sockeye, this fall. Silver Bay is now paying out $1.45 per pound of sockeye to fishermen, a 20-cent increase from the previous total of $1.25. Both processors are also offering more money for better quality fish. Abby Frederick is a spokesperson for Silver Bay.
Obviously, the base price comes out earlier in the season. And so now that we can see where it's at, where sales are going, and have a really confident look at where things are at, we're just excited to kind of celebrate that with our fleet.
Peter Pan Seafoods is also upping its base price by 20 cents to $1.45 per pound, according to a statement from spokesperson Becca Polipchuk. There are notable increases compared to last year. According to preliminary data released in November from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the region's final adjusted price in 2020 was $1.06. Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association CEO Andy Wink says the COVID-19 pandemic and poor salmon runs made last year unusual.
The other thing that COVID did was it created a massive increase in just general business risk. If we all think back to March, April, May of 2020, we didn't know what the next 2 weeks were going to look like. It makes it very difficult for a business to make long-term plans for the next 3 months, 6 months, year. And so that affects how buyers buy. It affects sales strategies, inventory strategies, all of that.
Sockeye supply declined by 23% in 2020. Wink says if you exclude Bristol Bay, 2020 was one of the lowest harvests since 1979.
Some years you could have other species not doing as well. And so, you know, just not as much product, not as much revenue to work with that year. So that's hard to say what sort of impact that has exactly, but it's not great if you're trying to run a processing business. And, you know, fishermen and processors are linked pretty closely, right? What affects one affects the other.
But this year, preliminary data suggests that global sockeye production is up by 10% or 330 million pounds. That's attributed not only to Bristol Bay, but better runs and harvests outside of the region. In Alaska, estimated total harvest went from 517 million pounds of sockeye in 2020 to 858 million in 2021. A few areas more than doubled their harvest per pound this year, including Southeast and Prince William Sound. Bristol Bay's harvest was consistent with last year's total at 200 million pounds. On top of the better salmon runs and harvests, the demand for sockeye in the U.S. is also on the rise. Wink says more retailers are starting to carry sockeye, and the rise in demand is driving up the price. For example, Bristol Bay's first wholesale value for frozen, headed, and gutted salmon through the months of July and August are up by $1 at $4.33 per pound, while frozen fillets are up by 75 cents.
Typically, they'll either sell it frozen or they'll slack it out and sell it out of their case as a chilled product. And so, you know, the more stores that are doing that, the more demand that there's going to be out there. People that have Costco's near them probably have seen sockeye in Costco, as well as Sam's Club and a lot of the other places, right? But that's probably not something that was there several years ago, you know, on a year-round basis.
Overall, it's estimated that seafood processors paid fishermen working in Alaska a total of $643 million this year. That's more than double last year's total. Bristol Bay leads all areas with a value of $248 million, which is about 40% of the statewide total. It was also a record year for salmon runs in the bay, with 65.8 million fish. Next year could also be another record year for Bristol Bay. Fish and Game's preseason forecast predicts a run of 75.2 million fish. In Dillingham, I'm Tyler Thompson.
Support from the National Science Foundation will aid ice melt modeling at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. UAF glaciology researcher Andy Oschwanden and Geophysical Institute satellite observation expert Mark Fonstock are part of a broad NSF effort called Harnessing Data and Model Revolution. Oschwanden says the two will work together to manage high volumes of remote sensing data to model the melting of polar ice sheets.
Improve the model that we are developing to make it more efficient or better suited to handle these large data sets.
Oschwanden points out that UAF is uniquely positioned to take advantage of the NSF program.
Because in the same building as I am here at the Geophysical Institute, we also have the Alaska Satellite Facility, which is responsible to download and process data from several NASA satellites that we're going to use for our project.
Oschwanden pointed out that the goal of the ice melt model is much easier to communicate than the data management required to make it work.
Make better prediction of sea level rise. That's something I can tell people, but the mechanics are somewhat harder to convey to the general public.
UAF is part one of five Harnessing Data and Model Revolution Institutes, receiving a total of $75 million from the NSF over 5 years. Indigenous heavy metal band Merciless Indian Savages uses its music and lyrics to take a critical look at issues impacting Native people. KUCB's Kenesha McLaughlin Price sat down with the band's co-founder to talk about music and activism.
My name is Jacob, or Tichlach, my Unangach name. I'm from Akutan, which is a village in the Aleutians on Akutan Island. That's where I grew up most of my childhood, so that's where, you know, that's home for me.
Jacob Tichlach Stepitin co-founded and plays lead guitar for the Indigenous heavy metal group Merciless Indian Savages. They have song titles like Pseudo Savior, Manifest Death, and Kill the Man, Save the Indian. They grab your attention, but Stepitin says the point is to create an opportunity to talk about Indigenous issues. Raised in Nechan and Yigam, Stepitin's introduction to music was influenced by his community and kin. Heavy metal was popular when he was growing up in the Unangam village of about 100 people. He remembers growing up in his aunties and uncles' homes listening to Metallica.
And so as a kid, that was just one of the types of music that I was surrounded by, and I latched onto that. I would spend a lot of time at my cousin's house, and my older cousins, they all played Metallica and they all played instruments. And I just thought they were really cool, you know, like all my cool older cousins, and they're all jamming out, playing Metallica songs together. That's kind of where it originated. And then it just expanded from there.
Stepitin started his music journey when he was 12. And has been dialing in his metal riffs since. In 2014, he began playing music with his college roommate, another Indigenous metalhead, and together the two founded MIS. Their music addresses a lot of heavy topics, some that come from their own experiences.
I think our lyrical content focuses a lot on things that make us angry about, you know, the Indigenous experience. Because I feel like you could also write a lot of really positive music, but that's the nature of the genre. You know, we're metalheads, we're passionate about metal, so the nature of the genre isn't really positive.
Each song that the band writes highlights an aspect of the Indigenous experience. But more specifically, Stepitin says they want to call attention to the histories and systems that perpetuate colonization.
In the Declaration of Independence, it calls the Indigenous people of the land merciless Indian savages.
Stepitin says racist language in the Declaration was included in a list of wrongdoings the King of England had committed against the United States.
One of those bad things, supposedly, is, I think the quote is like, he has brought on the merciless Indian savages, and then says something about how they only know anything about war and death or killing or something like that. So it's pretty brutal, and it's obviously like extremely racist, which is not a surprise for something that was written in the 1700s.
Stepitin says their band name is an educational opportunity.
But like I said, I don't think we're trying to embrace this name as if it's a valid description for who we are. It's like an intentional misnomer.
After graduating college in 2019, Stepitin and his fellow band members relocated to Tempe, Arizona, the ancestral homelands of the Ocumel-Alvim people. With the music scene rising again since the beginning of the pandemic, MIS looks forward to performing together more and playing their debut album, Kill the Man, Save the Indian. Reporting from Ululum, Tanungan, I'm Kenesha McLaughlin-Price.
The 300-foot-wide star that normally provides a bright spot on Anchorage's dark winter horizon should be up and running soon after an avalanche knocked out a chunk of its bulbs. That's according to officials for Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Since the 1980s, Anchorage residents looking north have had the view of the large star on Mount Gordon Lion in Arctic Valley starting the day after Thanksgiving. But this year, when a crew of airmen with the 773rd Civil Engineer Squadron went to turn the lights on, half the bulbs didn't work, says J-Bear spokeswoman Erin Eaton.
It appears that there was an avalanche that had taken out a portion of the supports and the wiring bulbs and what have you.
Since Friday, crews have worked to get the lights back on, which are located about 4,000 feet up the mountain. Eaton says they have contended with below zero wind chill and snowy skies to get all 350 light bulbs changed out.
It's like a 25 to 45 degree angle at some areas of that star, and so they had to tie themselves off and use safety harnesses to get the work done.
Anchorage residents looking for the star tonight should see it. She says she believes this is the first time the star lighting occurred after this Anchorage City of Lights celebration, which is held the day after Thanksgiving. The star will stay lit until the last Iditarod musher crosses the finish line next year. The results of a public opinion survey on tourism in Juneau are out. About 2,400 Juneau residents weighed in. On the overall effect of tourism, the majority of people who responded say they thought it had a positive effect on them. Just over a third said tourism had both positive and negative impacts. 20% said it didn't have any impact on them. And just 8% of the people said tourism has a negative impact. These trends are similar to results from past surveys. The city has been conducting these surveys since the 90s. Heather Hoglund from the McKinley Research Group presented the survey findings to the Juneau Assembly on Monday. She said she thought it was significant that the results were so similar for the past 19 years, considering how much the tourism industry has changed during that time.
So between 2002 and 2021, we almost doubled our cruise passenger volume. But really, these responses did not change very much, within 4 percentage points, and some in just 2 or 3 percentage point change. So even though it might seem boring, it's actually pretty remarkable that these responses are so consistent.
Residents who lived in downtown or Thane were more likely to respond with negative impacts of tourism than those who live in other parts of the city. And people who live in those areas or on Douglas said they felt more impacts overall from tourism than people who lived in Lemon Creek, the Mendenhall Valley, or out the road. More people also responded that they were negatively impacted by tourism online than through the phone survey. Hoglund says this could be because people who felt impacted by tourism were most likely to take the survey.
The number one preference would be a cap of 5 large ships per day in Juneau's harbor.
The full report of the survey's results can be found at ktoo.org or on the Juneau City website.
Today's KMXT Local News is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Small companies win big at Alaska's new product contest. More after this.
The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute works to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. Learn more at alaskaseafood.org.
Small Alaska businesses took home top honors at the Alaska Symphony of Seafood Competition held last week at Pacific Marine Expo in Seattle. The contest, hosted by the Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation since 1994, levels the playing field between large and small companies and helps showcase new consumer-ready seafood products. Julie Decker is AFDF Director.
Through the contest, we get to evaluate new products that are coming into the marketplace, and then we help promote those across the country and the world.
All market-ready entries are judged by an expert panel, and first-place winners were announced in 6 categories. Top winner at retail was Echo Falls Wild Alaskan Smoked Salmon Tapas Sliced Mediterranean by Ocean Beauty Seafoods, which also won in the salmon category. On the small business side, Alaska-grown Ribbon Kelp by Seagrove Kelp Company of Craig won top food service honors. Wild Alaska Pollock Jerky by Neptune Snacks took top honors in the whitefish category. Deep Blue Sea Bath Soak by Water Body of Wrangell won first place in the Beyond the Plate category. The inaugural winner of the first Bristol Bay Choice Award went to Wild Caught Bristol Bay Sockeye by Alaskan Leader Seafoods. That company's Wild Caught Alaska Black Cod also was selected as Seattle's People's Choice. Second and third place winners and the overall grand prize winner are kept under wraps until a second symphony event at Juneau in February. All top winners receive booth space at the Seafood Expo North America event at Boston in March and entry into its National New Products Contest. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the first day of November, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 9:28. It will set again at 4:28. That will give us 7 hours of daylight, a loss of 2 minutes and 48 seconds compared to yesterday. A record high for this date was 48, set in 1950, and a record low was 6, set in 1967 and 1971. Currently closer to the latter, we are 16 degrees out at the airport, 18 degrees according to the thermometer clamped to our tiny back porch behind the station. We're looking for more snow showers today. They are still saying we might see partly sunny skies this afternoon with a high near 18. West wind to 30, gusting to 40 today. Partly cloudy skies tonight with a low around 18. Strike that a low around 16 with northwest winds 25 to 30, gusting as high as 50 tonight. Partly sunny tomorrow with a high near 22, northwest to 30, gusting to 50 again tomorrow. Looking at our local tides, We just had a high tide at 11 o'clock on the east side, so we have an outgoing tide. Our next low tide will be at 5:44 p.m. and be minus 1/10 of a foot, followed by a high tide at 12:01 a.m., just about midnight, of 7.4 feet here on the east side. Our next low tide tomorrow morning will be at 5:27 a.m. and be 1.8 feet, followed by a high tide at 11:45 a.m. of 10.3 feet here on the east side. Over on the west side, you have a low tide coming up at 6:20 p.m. That will be minus 9/10 of a foot in Larsen Bay, followed by a high tide at 12:30 a.m. of 13 feet. Your low tide for tomorrow morning on the west side will be at 6:17 a.m. and be 2.2 feet. And your high tide for tomorrow in Larsen Bay will be at 12:23 p.m. and be 16.5 feet. Mariners, we have some not-so-swell weather out there. Heavy freezing spray warnings everywhere around the island. And for Marmot Island to Sitkanak, we have a gale warning through Thursday for Kodiak's east side offshore with a heavy freezing spray warning through Thursday as well. For south of Dangerous Cape today, west winds to 45 knots and seas to 18 feet. North of Dangerous Cape, northwest 25, increasing to 35 knots this afternoon, seas to 12 feet with heavy freezing spray in both cases. For tomorrow, look for northwest winds to 40 knots, seas to 14 feet with heavy freezing spray. Over in the Shelikof Strait, gale warning through Thursday and a heavy freezing spray warning through Thursday as well. West wind to 45 knots today in the Shelikof, gusting to 60 knots out of bays and passes, seas to 12 feet with heavy freezing spray. For tomorrow in the Shelikof, west wind to 40 knots, gusting to 55 knots out of bays and passes, seas to 11 feet with heavy freezing spray tomorrow in the Shelikof as well. The Kodiak Borough Assembly will meet for a regular meeting on Thursday, December 2nd at 6:30 p.m. in the Bayside Fire Hall. This meeting is open to the public. It also will be streamed online at www.kodiakak.us and broadcast on KMXT on 100.1 FM. On the agenda are Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center improvements, Kodiak Fisheries Research Center improvements, borough building boilers, and the local government lost revenue relief program. Comments can be made during the meeting in person or by phone at 907-486-3231. They also may be emailed to clerks@kodiakak.us by noon on Thursday. As part of a traditional foods initiative, Chiniak Bay Elder House is requesting wild game donations from the Kodiak community. Their elders are thankful for opportunities to eat wild, nourishing local fish and game. Donations can be dropped off gutted and whole or quartered at Kodiak Island Smokehouse, and processing will be paid for by Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center. Just contact Kelsey for more information. Her number is 907-481-2488. The miniature quilt show and bake sale is coming up. That's happening December 11th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the St. John the Fisherman's Church. Enter your miniature quilts for show or sale. Quilt dimensions should be close to 30 by 30 or smaller. As a prize for best in show, quilters may enter up to 5 miniature quilts per entry fee, and the entry fee is a mere $10. Show participants may donate 5% of their proceeds to benefit St. James Church. The quilt entry deadline is December 10th, and you need to contact Ellen Lester at 942-3868, and entry forms can be emailed to you for your convenience.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
And And don't forget during these frigid temperatures to let your water run in your sink to avoid troublesome pipe freezings.